We're really happy to have Lane Kennedy joining us. And Lane, of course, is an internationally known photographer. His feature work has appeared in such publications as Smithsonian, Life, Sports Illustrated, Newsweek, National Geographic, Traveler, in the New York Times, and Outside. I think you get the idea that he does some beautiful work, and it's really out there everywhere. He's also found in numerous books for different publications or publishers, including the National Geo Society, Nature Conservancy, Minnesota Historical Society Press, and his latest book is about Iceland, and it's called Light Over Iceland. Photography at 66 degrees north, and it's an amazing book. I've been able, in fact, I have it on the screen right in front of me. Lane, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Buck, thanks for having me. This is great. Nice to talk to you.
You probably thought I was going to talk through the whole interview there.
That's just fine. Better you than me. You've got a better voice.
Oh, I don't think so. Not hardly. We've been able to enjoy your photography up here in Cook County over the years because you have a connection to Cook County.
I do. Well, I mean, I just love Cook County. I've been coming up there since, 1975 when I moved to Minnesota from Alaska. And I think like a lot of people, you get introduced to Lake Superior and there's oftentimes just no turning back. And that's always been my attraction, getting up there. And so that's been Grand Marais, but kind of been my second home for, the last, I shouldn't say how many years, but a lot of years.
And you also have been an instructor and a big help with classes down at North House Folk School.
Yeah, I've been lucky. I've been teaching classes there now for a little over a decade. And, what not a better place to launch from than, kind of covering the North Shore and working out of the North House, which has always kind of been my type of workshops. Buck, mine are, we don't just go take pretty pictures. There's usually a theme involved, and we try to tell stories. We kind of connect the dots. So all these people who are used to traveling, and they come back, they don't want to just have, 100 sunrises and sunsets. We try to time into a storyline that connects the dots, Grand Marais to the lake to the rivers to the, to the North Shore and the rocks and so on and so forth. So it's a good kind of an editorial look at the North Shore at the North House class. So a lot of fun.
When I started doing this program here on WTIP, I found that it changed the way I look at certain things. Suddenly, when I'm reading the paper, I'm thinking Roadhouse. When I'm seeing events, I'm thinking Roadhouse. When I do listen to music, I'm thinking, does that fit in?
Sure.
Now, in your role as a photographer, a much larger role, of course, and your travels, I'm sure you find that dominates the way that you look at the world.
Oh, no question. No question about it. It's funny that you say that too, Buck, because, one of the other classes I took at the North House that directly ties into photography, I took the Norwegian Ale Bowl pole lathe class at the North House. And my gosh, it took me 3 days to learn to turn a bowl, but it was a blast. But it's funny, I became so attached to wood turning that now I'm in my eighth year of turning, and I just love doing it. So in doing that, like you said, when I travel up and down the North Shore now, I see trees differently. I see the forest differently. And how this ties in with photography is that one day I was coming back and I was passing the Cascade River, the spot there where the river flows into Lake Superior. And I glanced up to the right and there's a big tree there with a burl on it. And it has a cut in the tree, a defect in the tree that looked like a grin, somebody smiling. And it immediately said off to me, gosh, that burl looks like a person. And so for me, it launched an idea immediately that I was going to do a kid's book on Croy, who's one of my daughters, and the magic burl. And it's going to be a talking burl that teaches this little girl all about the forest and the trees. And I can use my photographs to illustrate the book. And so you're right. You hit these things and you see differently depending upon what you're interested in. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, and you have such a vivid imagination.
Well, I'm glad you didn't say crazy. That helps. Thank you, Buck.
Vivid because it shows up in your photography. I know Dick and I were talking before we were on air about what it takes to be a photographer like you. It takes that type of talent.
Yeah, I think it just takes time. I think it was Bresson was the one that said, your first 10,000 photographs are your worst. And you know, if you look at it, you know, from the first time you picked up a guitar and you did a G chord, and you went, oh my gosh, that sounds bad. I can hear my fingers rattling the strings, and it probably wasn't even a G chord. You know, photography is no different. It takes time to find out how to acquire depth in your work. And I think the real key in photography is, you know, how do you interpret visually what it is you feel emotionally? And once you can answer that question, no matter if you're using an iPhone or if you're using the fanciest Nikon or Hasselblad out there, once you can define that question, you automatically become a better shooter, and your work becomes more intuitive, it becomes more instinctive, and I think it communicates better. And I think, just like music, we can't expect that photography is going to communicate to everybody who looks at your work. Some people are going to like it, some people aren't. That's just the way it is. The same is with music.
Yeah, that's,
you just do what's true to you, you know.
That's so true. You know, you can hear musicians that may not be technically that great, but if they are good at capturing emotion, it makes the song. And the same with your photographs.
Exactly right. Exactly. I mean, I it's funny. I tend to use Neil Young as an analogy because some of my good friends are really, just really good guitar players. And they talk about Neil Young, who's one of my favorite musicians. And same thing. They said, well, that guy can't play the guitar. I said, yes, he can. And it's this ongoing argument. But like you said, Buck, he plays in a way that I understand it and I appreciate it. I don't need to hear a guitar whiz. I just want to hear music. And photography is the same way. So when we can create visual music when we're out there, it makes a big plus. And that's why Iceland was such an attractive place to go. I think any visual artist who has ever gone to Iceland has rarely ever been disappointed. It's just a plethora of wonderful images for the visual person.
Now, when you travel to Iceland, how does that differ from when I travel to Iceland? What things do you do because you're going to take photographs there?
Yeah, I don't know that it would be much different, to tell you the truth, Buck. I think the big thing is that, you know, you're an outdoors guy too. You know what it's like to be outside and the concept of preparation when you're up north. And Iceland's really no different. I think the big thing is, photographer going to Iceland, you have to be prepared for what you're going to encounter there. I mean, Iceland is not, you know, their nicest road isn't even as nice as the North Shore Drive. They have the Ring Road, which circumnavigates the island, but it only does kind of an interior loop. And of course, Iceland is filled with these fjords, which can be, you know, 100 miles going in and around and following one of these fingers along the coast. And those are oftentimes gravel roads. And so you have to be careful. You have to be prepared. You have to move slowly. That's just the way it is. And I think one of the things that I've heard from most people who've gone to Iceland casually, they just say, my gosh, this is like crossing the Dakotas. You know, it's so flat and there's nothing here. Well, it's like the Dakotas are beautiful. If you get out of your car and walk around the prairie, you start finding magic everywhere. But if you're just looking for something grand, like a national park, like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite, you have to look a little harder in Iceland. But man, it's there. It's you know, I think I talked about that in the introduction to the book, that I've always kind of viewed Iceland as little big land, because it's a small place. It's about the size of Kentucky, but yet the scale of Iceland is like all the Grand Canyon. It's a phenomenal place to go photograph.
We're speaking with Lane Kennedy, and Lane's latest book about Iceland, it's called Light Over Iceland, Photography at 66 Degrees North. I'd like to take just this moment to encourage everybody listening to this interview, if you're next to your computer, Google Lane Kennedy, and when you get his website up, click on Iceland. And you'll be able to scroll through 32 of the most beautiful photographs about Iceland as we talk about Iceland, and get a better concept of what Lane is talking about. Now, I did that last night, and I had a few questions for you about technique.
You bet.
And I looked at one right away, and it's maybe the fourth or fifth photograph in, and it shows what appears to be a garage or a workroom with some bottles on a shelf and a couple of ski poles sticking up.
Oh, yeah. The abandoned herring factory in Dupavik.
It looks like a painting.
Isn't that trippy? Isn't that just the trippiest place? You know, it's about 5-hour drive from Reykjavik, and I'd heard about this place from a photographer who I met while I was teaching a workshop in Iceland, who said that he came a couple days earlier and he found this abandoned herring factory up in Djupavik, you know, with a population of, I think, 5. And he showed me some of his pictures, you know, on his camera monitor, and I went, oh, my gosh, Daniel, this looks fantastic. And I said, is there access? You know, can we get into it? He said, yeah, the lady who owns the hotel is trying to restore this place, and she'd be willing to, you know, let you in, blah, blah, blah. And so I gave her a call and tracked it down and said, well, listen, after the workshop, I'd be happy to buzz over there and spend a day or night there. And she agreed, and so we went over, and it was the most fascinating place. And that particular picture, Buck, that you've seen, people ask me, well, is that an HDR image, you know, this high dynamic range where people, you know, really juice up photography? I really don't do that. And this was actually real. There was a combination, I think, of some of the chemical breakdown of the paint, as well as there was a blue room behind me that the sun was hitting and bouncing that blue light back into the room. Mm. And then it had all these, you know, these multicolored, really dusty bottles and dials. And I actually had an LED light with me because, believe it or not, this is one of the fun things about the medium that I think people, especially who shoot digital, don't quite grasp yet, especially for us old guys that, you know, we're kind of weaned on film, is that digital can see things in low light that we can't see as human. And so once you believe in that and you put your camera on a tripod and you're into a room that's almost dark and you do a long exposure, that's the result. That's what you can see. And so that combination of reciprocity, the light that was bouncing off the wall behind me and a long exposure brought out this absolutely magical photograph of this room. I mean, and I saw it on my monitor. I just was jumping up and down like a kid in a candy store. You're going, yes, yes. You get so excited. And, of course, we spent hours and hours and hours there just going from room to room and photographing this kind of decaying building, which was just fantastic.
I look at that, it's hard for me to believe that it is a photograph. It looks like something that I should have framed.
It has that look, doesn't it?
Yes.
That texture to it. It's almost like a canvas. It's almost like canvas felt.
And some of that is the long exposure?
The long exposure can sometimes, through a long exposure, you know, you can get a shift in your color balance. It wasn't very much. I mean, this is the way it looked, but the LED light that I shined on it to kind of shine on the bottles added a little bit of the color, and then that blue light that was bouncing from the room before, and then there was a blue cast to that weird paint that was in the room anywhere, which, you know, I'm guessing was some kind of, through time, a combination of probably algae and chemical breakdown. You know how concrete can sometimes start to decay and fall apart. And, of course, you saw the environment in there. There's all kinds of weird things and oils and things that are in there. So who knows what it was coming from. But, man, it sure was pretty.
In some of your photographs, you use black and white or you use color. And in some of those, one in particular I'm trying to find here, you use both in the same photograph. It's somehow... it appears to be somebody picking tomatoes.
Oh yes, yes, yes. In one of the greenhouses. Now that image is not in the book. That's just one of my older Iceland images that I put together. You know, that's one of those things, and just kind of experimenting and drawing attention to a particular area through the use of a combination of color and black and white. And in fact, it's a good point, Buck. When you go through the book, Iceland is one of those places. You know, since I was I was brought up shooting 4x5 photography. I was actually a large format shooter before I kind of turned into an editorial shooter, then kind of went back down to 35mm. I shot all large format, and it was all black and white. I mean, if you went out for a day and shot 6 pictures, you had a great day. And every shot took a lot of time and a lot of effort, and the vision had to be perfect. And from end of the ground glass to the end of the ground glass, I mean, you knew every inch of that frame. And black and white, especially in places like Iceland, just communicates with more volume than sometimes with the color. And so in putting the book together, there were some images, like some of the basaltic, the Kalmar geology, for example. If you look at the book and you go to blurb.com, you can see the entire book there. The first image in the book is a large black and white photograph. And, you know, in color, it almost looks exactly the same because it has a very monochromatic feel to it. But at the very bottom of that photograph, where the ocean was coming up and hitting the cliffs, it created kind of a green color on the bottom from the algae growth. And to me, it distracted from the impact of this columnar geology and the feel for the massive nature of this geology. And so by converting it to black and white, we eliminated what was confusing and brought it right back down to what the core was. And so it kind of gets back to what we talked about earlier, that, you know, what am I trying to say? What do I want this photograph to feel like? And when I saw that cliff, I went, that's a black and white shot. And so it was just natural to be able to convert it that way.
Is it true that black and white often can create more drama?
You know, yes and no. You know, for example, if you go back to the shot inside the herring factory at Dupovic, that room with that color would be nothing in black and white. It had to be in color. Color is what created that image, made me stop and shoot it, and it was not a black and white photograph. But the columnar geology, some of the aerial photos that I shot in Iceland, you know, are black and white, and it really defines the landscape. And when you say, does it make it more real? That, you know, it's funny. I'm probably dating myself here big time. You may understand this, Buck. But, you know, when we were kids, remember the show Andy Griffith of Mayberry?
Sure.
Okay. When I was a kid, I always wanted to. I loved that opening of the show when they walked out with their fishing poles and they had the pine trees and the lake. I said, man, I could put myself right there. But remember, that show was in black and white. And it was great in black and white. And what's funny is that when that TV show then went color, like 7 or 8 years later, the year after, it was canceled. And I've always remembered that because it was real when it was in black and white. But when they added color, it gave us too much information, and we didn't want that. We wanted to have our imagination be in black and white. And it's kind of funny. The show was canceled after it went color. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it just changed. It changed the whole emotion of what you were watching.
It really did. It really did. And so photography is no different than that. And there are some images that just require them to be presented in black and white, and others that require themselves to be brought in color.
And you have to know the difference.
You do. And I think you get, and that's just, again, that's just experience. You know, that's just playing the G chord several times.
When you traveled to Iceland, you'd seen photographs, maybe you've been there before. Did you have certain aspects of the country that you wanted to cover?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, I'm drawn to wild places. And Iceland, of course, is just almost completely a wild, isolated place, as well as it has the ice. You know, I grew up in Alaska, and so glaciers and what have you, glacial ice, that cobalt blue that you get from a glacier that it appears no place else on Earth, you know, except in ice, has always been an attraction. And so that has always been one of the big draws. But also, you know, when you go to Iceland, you have elbow room. And I've gotten increasingly frustrated on assignments that I've had in our national parks here in this country when I've got to jog for position with, you know, thousands of other people sometimes to try to get a shot. I remember hiking into Utah once to get a shot of the iconic Sunrise Arch in Arches National Park. And, you know, it's this long hike to get in there. Then I got there, there was at least 300 other people already
wow.
there waiting to get the shot. And I went, oh, my gosh, you know. And the thing about Iceland is that I think that I appreciate more than anything else is, you know, there's no signs for the most part. You know, you don't have to worry about seeing billboards. When you pull into a waterfall, of which there are thousands of them in Iceland because of the glaciers melting off the top of the center of the island, you know, if you want to kill yourself and be careless, you're welcome to do so. And you don't have to have a sign that says, you know, park here, deposit $10, you know, or do this or do that. And that's one of the great attractions, I think, for me, is that you really have this place all to yourself when you get off the main road. And that's, you know, there's not too many places anymore that you can do that.
Now, were you on assignment there earlier, or were you on assignment this time and broadened it into a book, or how did your trip evolve?
You know, I've been going to Iceland off and on now for about 12 years. And, you know, I've brought my son over there on one of my trips, and I've had several assignments over there. I taught a workshop there last year and teaching another one there this next fall. And so it's been accumulation of all of these trips going back to where I finally had just gotten to the point where I said, you know, geez, I keep saying I'm going to do a book. And Iceland's becoming a more and more popular destination. It was just time for me to go ahead and put a book together. And if nothing else, you know, everybody needs motivation to do this. And so this book, as opposed to the last book that we talked about, Buck, which was Paddle North, you know, that was published by the Historical Society Press, which is on the Boundary Waters in Quetico. That was published by a publisher, you know, the Minnesota Historical Society Press. They do a great job. This book, and of course, the publishing industry has changed dramatically in the last 4 or 5 years, and the quality of self-published book has gone up dramatically in the last 5 or so years. And so now putting a book together on your own and publishing it, self-publishing it, is now a vehicle for a lot of people to be able to showcase your work to a very specific audience. And it's book on demand, and so we don't have to print 5,000 copies. You can print 5 to give out as Christmas gifts, and so the cost is way down. The books are more expensive to purchase because it is book on demand, you know, whereas if you're printing 5,000, there's a discount because they print 5,000 books. But, you know, at the same time, you know, when you print one at a time, it's more expensive. But it's worth it, and they do a beautiful job. And blurb.com is the one that I use for several of my books. And the newest Iceland book is published right through them. And so I have both an ebook out on this one as well as the hardcover book. And so as soon as it came out, I immediately, you know, 5 copies for my family, and they're all getting an Iceland book for Christmas.
You know, we talked earlier briefly, and I just wanted to cover this while we have you on the phone, because I know a lot of people think about it, and that has to do with how your photography changed when digital came out, and do you still use film, and if so, what for?
You know, I don't use film that much anymore, and the film that I do use, believe it or not, is only with my 2.25 Hasselblad camera. And I have very specific reasons if I'm going to be using that particular format. But the problem is that now with film, my darkroom now is filled with bowls. So I haven't used it very often. So to print, you know, to get back into the darkroom and do things the way I used to do things is not non-existent, but it's very infrequent that I do that. And so even if I shoot film, you still scan it and turn it into a digital file in order to print it. So in some ways, you know, there's no reason for me to go back to film. The change with digital was a pretty extreme one. I think that digital it's a hard way to call this, Buck, but I think digital has gotten to be 90% of what I used to be able to feel I could get from film. And there are still some problems with digital in some areas, but then again, the flip side of that is that when I go back and scan an old Kodachrome from 20 years ago, I think, my gosh, look at the limitations in this film that I don't have anymore with digital. Mm-hmm. And that really has opened up ways that we can see as photographers, knowing that I don't have to pass up that dark blueberry on the Gunflint Trail because it doesn't have much light. I can get it in digital now. And that's something with film, you just said, oh, too dark, I got to come back another time. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference. That's a huge difference in the medium.
We've been speaking with Lane Kennedy, and Lane, of course, internationally known photographer. He spends some time, as much as he can, up here on the North Shore. He's been teaching outdoor photography at North House Folk School at different times during the year. He has a brand new book out called Light Over Iceland, Photography at 66 Degrees North. Lane, is that book available in Grand Marais yet in town, do you believe?
No, I don't think it is, Buck, because it's a book that you have to go online to purchase.
Okay.
And then you can purchase it either as an ebook, because so many people have, you know, the iPads now, and then it can be published as a hardcover book. And it's a beautiful hardcover book. It's a big, you know, I don't know what you would call it, a landscape book, picture book, that kind
table
of a format.
Book, yeah.
But no, it's beautiful. And the nice thing is that if you go online to blurb.com and just, you could type my name in or just Light Over Iceland, and you can actually see the entire book in the print version, every page. It's a great website, how they allow you to go through the entire book, thumb through the book, and see the entire book before you decide you wanted it or just purchase it as an ebook, which is substantially cheaper than doing it that way. And I think in the long run, you know, from a photographer, from a business person, you know, that side of the coin, I really see that the print book will only be for people who really have a passion about Iceland and or photography. And I think it's the ebook which will be more successful, and more people will purchase that version because more people have the iPads now. And from, you know, the fact that they can do this worldwide, anybody who has an interest in Iceland and wants to, you know, download an ebook, boom, they've got it. They've got it forever on their iPad.
Now, people also can buy individual photographs from you, can't they, in large photographs?
Oh, you bet. You bet. Yeah, that's always
And Christmas is right around the corner.
You bet.
just Google your name, and your website should pop up.
It's all there. It's all there.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Lane, for joining us.
It's great to talk to you.
We hope that you're back on the North Shore very soon.
I hope to be up there very soon.